To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. You heard the song, so you know what you're listening to. My name is Don, and it doesn't matter if you've listened to one episode or all the episodes we've done. There hasn't been any time I've been on a show and I haven't mentioned the person sitting on the other side of the microphone, my buddy, Britt. Say hello.
Hello.
Britt and I met back in Abilene Christian University back in 1981. My whole life, I've read comics, loved comics, wanted to draw comics. And I was an art major. I met Britt, a fellow art major. We knew each other for a while. And then I found out he loved comics just as much. Same thing. Drew comics, wanted to do it for a living. One thing that always amazed me was, even though we both had a lot of the similar things, we liked certain artists and, you know, certain styles, Britt went to a certain further with it because he understood the nuts and bolts. He understood about composition of pages. He understood about storytelling. A lot of the nuts and bolts in the business world. All I did was just basically draw characters all the time. So, like I said, it's kind of amazing when you got two people with similar interests, but then they're completely different. So, what have you been looking at lately?
Oh, I've been looking at all kinds of stuff. I have been reading more books lately than comics, but all of the books that I was thinking about were comics related, so yeah. I still got my foot in. I think you all have mentioned in the past the Hoopla app for tablets.
I think Rook had mentioned that before.
It's a great resource because it allows you to check out in digital form graphic novels from your local public library, and I probably use that more than I do any other form of reading comics these days. It's free. It's a free service. You've got to coordinate it with your local library. And different libraries have different rules. Like I know people in Dallas who have it, that the Dallas library, I think, allows them to have three things checked out. I live in Richardson, a suburb of Dallas, and here the rule is seven things a month.
Okay.
And so it's pretty nice because a lot of the stuff that they have available isn't necessarily physically present in your local library. So, and I notice a lot of things that are kind of, quote, in the news, unquote, will show up. So right now, like, Hoopla has a bunch of collections that feature Captain Marvel because of this new movie coming out.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm catching up on some of that stuff because it's not a character that I've actively followed the last few years and they've done a lot with. So it's kind of nice. But they have not just comics, but also books and audiobooks and even movies that you can check out. And the it works differently for different formats. Like the comics, you download onto your device, so you can actually read them offline. You don't have to be connected to the network for that. But music, on the other hand, I listened to a Greatest Hits of Queen album, and it would only play when my tablet was actually connected to a Wi-Fi network. So if I was out in the car or whatever, I couldn't listen to that. And I think movies are the same way. They don't literally download to your device. But comics, on the other hand, audiobooks, books, those do. And then you just have to, quote, return them in the system after whatever the required time is. I think usually it's a 3-week checkout for everything, but that probably is set by the library.
Right.
So anyway, it's kind of a nice resource. I have run into some bugs with the app. Sometimes it tells you that you have several borrows remaining, but it won't let you check anything out because you then get a message saying that you can't check anything more out, and it's not always accurate. But what I found is that that seems to be something that cycles every 24 hours. So if on Tuesday it's not allowing you to check something out, even though you know you have remaining borrows allowed for, on Wednesday morning, you could probably go ahead and download it then. So sometimes it requires a little bit of persistence. But it's kind of a nice feature and a nice way to get your hands on some stuff without having to shell out the money for it. So,
you know,
anyway.
I've always said, way back in the 80s, you and I were talking, we were living coast to coast. You were in California, I was down here in Florida. And I had said to you, I wish there was a library of comics, because there was a lot of comics that I didn't buy, but I was still interested in reading. I remember Greg Teakston had a book called Viking Heroes, I think it was called. I'd see people buy it. I was always interested. I just, again, wasn't interested in buying it. But I've always wished there was something like it. On the sidebar of the blog, I've got a link called Comics Plus. It's a library edition. It's what you talked about, where you could read comics from your local library online. But your library has to participate. And
right.
My local library does not, or did not at the time. I haven't tried since I've added the link. My daughter is in South Carolina. She uses the library extensively. And she was upset that her library wasn't either, which I understand. All you had to do is contact your library and ask them if they do it. But this was a new one to me. I'd like to try it.
Well, Hoopla, I think, was set up in conjunction with some of the big media companies. So I think that probably has something to do with the materials that are available. Because like I said, they aren't always necessarily something that's in your local library, even though you're checking it out through your local library's auspices. Like I just listened to the entire series of books that are called Mortal Engines, that recent movie came out.
Yeah.
I saw that and enjoyed it, and I wanted to read the books, and so I listened to the audiobooks of them. And all four of the books were in Hoopla, so I got to listen to them free of charge. And they're really well produced, so.
Nice. Now, when you get the comics through this application, is it like the Comixology, where you can click on the panels and enlarge them? Or is this just like a scanned images of the pages?
No, it has kind of a guided mode, like Comixology does. Or you can be looking at the whole page, and you can zoom in to a limited degree on specific panels. I tend to go with the guided mode more often than not. So it's, making each panel as large as possible, because my eyesight's not that great. So I want to be able to read it and see the details of the artwork. So that's what works for me.
It makes sense, yeah. Yeah, I like both ways. I find I do enjoy reading it, with the guided mode, and again, enlarging the panels. But I also like to see just the page itself, the way it was originally intended. But
right.
It's a different experience, each way.
Absolutely. Because some pages were definitely designed to be taken in as a whole. Steranko, Neil Adams, there were a bunch of different artists that really put a lot of effort into that. Bill Sienkiewicz. And if all you see are the static panels separated from one another, then you lose some of that. But I will say this. Usually when there is a dynamic where you need to see the whole page, the guided mode will show you the whole page, and then as you progress, it'll go to each panel individually. So you end up seeing it both ways. And I guess that's probably determined by the personal perspective of whoever's responsible for setting up the guided mode for that comic, but
yeah.
More than it is by you as the reader. But Anyway.
Nice. Well, we'll have this added to the sidebar of the blog, so when you listen to this episode and you're interested, you can go to it. Anyway, I'm sorry, Britt, what were you saying?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Oh. Well, that was it. I do like that. One thing we've talked about a lot on the show was I like to go to comic shops. I do miss the fact that you don't actually see comics in the drugstores, convenience stores, any of the places we used to find them at. I think that kind of, well, it did hurt the industry. We don't have a lot of younger people coming in. And I understand, you know, there's video games and other things that, you know, especially with the phones now. But I do think it's good if you have something like this available to the general public and they can see it. It kind of piques an interest from an audience that doesn't, that aren't like us, that just hits the comic shops all the time.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see comics that much and when I go to the grocery store or wherever, but I don't know what happened with Barnes & Noble. For a while there, they were carrying comics, but the last time I went into one, I was really unpleasantly surprised because they had aisles and aisles of toys in there. This was before Christmas, so, I mean, they were probably gearing up for that shopping season. But there wasn't a single comic book up at the magazine area. Now, of course, they do have a graphic novel section and a manga section in the store, so you could still see stuff there. But the floppy monthly comics, for a while there, they had a pretty strong selection, and there wasn't anything there the last time I went in. And that may be different from individual store to individual store. I don't know. But I thought that was unfortunate.
It could be. That's one thing everywhere people talk about was the movies don't really translate into people reading comic books. You know, all the superhero movies out. And the cartoons and stuff. You can find all the toys. You can find clothes. You see so many people wearing T-shirts of Superman, Deadpool, you know, especially Batman. You name it. You see the T-shirt for those characters. And those people, a lot of times, have never even seen a comic. They just are aware of the movies.
Now, have you been to the DC Universe? Have you gone into that at all? The online thing?
Oh, no, I don't even know what that is.
Oh, well, they set up their own streaming service, kind of like a Netflix or Hulu or something, where they have DC character movies and TV series. And so they have a lot of already existing content, like all the Batman movies that Tim Burton made and so forth. But they are also making new content. There's going to be a Doom Patrol series, and they have a Titans series that's been going on. I haven't bought it because I already have subscriptions with Netflix and with Amazon Prime and CBS All Access, and I figured that was enough for me. I mean, that represents more stuff than I will ever watch, but DC started this service just a month or two back, and some of the guys I know that are in the comic book reading club that I'm in have memberships in that, so they've talked a little bit about it. And Disney has been for a long time threatening to start their own streaming service, and that would include all the Marvel stuff. Now, the thing about the DC Universe that's different than, say, Netflix is that it's not just movies and TV shows, but apparently there's also a significant amount of digital comics on there.
Oh.
And what they have available varies by character and by, you know, this month versus the next month. I haven't personally experienced it. I've just had some of my friends telling me a little bit about it.
Actually, that sounds kind of neat.
Yeah, I think so. I'm just not looking for an additional subscription fee right now. I might have to break down and get the Disney one with Disney and Pixar and Marvel under all the same banner. But
well, you're preaching to the choir because I don't have any of those. I've had Netflix off and on a couple of times. And I watched the first Star Trek Discovery episode that was on CBS. And then people I worked with were upset that I wasn't watching it. And I said, well, I'm not going to pay. It was just, you know, it's whatever the price was. I'm thinking, yeah, but my goodness. It says there's Netflix, there's this, there's Hulu. You know, I don't know. I call me old-fashioned, but I really don't want to have to subscribe to all these things. I don't have a lot of time to watch TV anyway, and when I do, I find it's,
sure.
I find it's basically watching DVDs that I buy. So,
well, I am enough of a Star Trek fan. I decided it was worth it for me, but I think everybody has to make that decision for themselves.
Right, right. How do you like that show, by the way?
I loved it.
Did you really?
I loved it. It has one of my favorite actresses in the entire world in it, Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that was one of the initial big draws for me.
Yeah, I liked that first episode she was on.
She actually proves to be the Emperor from the Mirror Mirror universe.
Really?
Yeah. So she's playing a pretty dark character in it, and she comes back across from that alternate universe with the Discovery crew, and not everybody back in the Prime universe knows that she's from the other universe. So she's working for Starfleet, but in a kind of a black ops type operation, and only a few people know who she really is.
Wow. Wow. Well, now you got me interested.
And the captain of the captain of the Discovery in the first season was actually from the Mirror Mirror universe, and he was one of her lieutenants, and he ended up getting killed, but Christopher Pike becomes the captain in the second season. So he's there. And the main character, Michael Burnham, she's the adopted sister of Spock.
Yeah.
Spock's parents adopted her after her parents were murdered. So it's got some interesting connections back to the original series, which irritates some people. But for me, as a fan of the original series, I've been loving it. So.
Yeah. Well, you always hear mixed reviews, and that's with anything. But I don't know. I haven't heard the things you're talking about. That does actually interest me. But I don't know. I'm still not going to buy it. So.
Well, I don't know any means to record it, but I think that they were going to be making DVDs of it available. So You may end up being able to see it that way.
That is one issue I've got with the streaming services is, you know, like on Netflix, well, I've had friends that had it, and they get upset because a lot of the stuff that they had in their queue to watch, you know, old movies and stuff, disappear. And I said, well, aren't there still other things? Yeah, but I have to go find it. It's hard to find. And I guess that's the thing. If you like a movie and you buy it, anytime you want to watch it, it's just there. Whereas it seems like a lot of these streaming services... I remember watching Adventure Time, and what was it, that cartoon, Bob's Burgers on Netflix. Well, now they're gone. Now they're on Hulu. I don't know. I like the fact if I like it and want to watch it, I can just get the DVD and watch it. Streaming services, I don't know. It's kind of like antenna TV. You know, you only can watch what they want you to watch.
Right.
But, like I said, there's a big plethora of stuff out there. And some of the original stuff all these stations, these streaming services are doing are really good. So,
I like how digital content has been made available for people who buy the DVDs or Blu-ray discs of things so that you not only have it on the disc, but you also have it in digital form where you can access it if you've got a smart TV
yes.
without putting the disc in. I've taken advantage of that some. On like, let's see. I'm trying to think the name of the app. I have it on my tablet, and it's like Movies Anywhere is one name, but it's also under another name, and it's on. I got a TV last year that it's a smart TV, and so I can watch things. I have some Pixar films and some science fiction films, some of my favorites that I've got in digital form, so I could pull them up anytime. That's kind of a nice feature where you don't have to go hunting for them.
Yeah, that is nice. That is nice.
Amazon actually does that too. So, and I have a Prime membership, so I've bought a few movies through them that are available that way.
Nice. All right. Well, when we were talking about doing the show, Britt said, "What should we discuss?" And I said, "Well, anything you want." So, you sent a list of comics that you've been reading, and the first one on the list is Atomic Robo by Brian Clevenger and Scott Winger.
Yes. Have you read any of that?
Way back in the Stone Ages when there was MySpace, I followed a page for Atomic Robo. I was really impressed. I liked the design of the character. I liked the covers. I'd look at the artwork. I thought it was just some amateur comic by some guy on the internet, you know, as you see. And
been doing it a long time.
Yeah, and I was staggered at the quality of the work. A mutual friend of ours, Scott Connor, he just carries on about it, and he gets on to me when I haven't read it. I've picked up a couple of Free Comic Day books. I've never seen it for sale anywhere. But I haven't particularly read it. I've just, you know, when I get the free books, I thumb through it and read it that way. It's good. But how far have you read into this?
Well, it's hard for me to say because it reminds me of the Hellboy books by Mike Mignola.
Yeah.
Not only because they take style cues from him in the artwork and in the writing style, but they also do it in story arcs, so there'll be a mini series and then another mini series, and you know, it kind of wraps up around one thing, and then they move on to another arc. So I'm not sure what percentage of the total amount is out there I've read, because it hasn't really been in a linear fashion. I've sort of read things as they became available.
Yeah.
Some of the books have been on Hoopla or maybe on Comixology Unlimited. And then some, like friends of mine that were into comics, have brought to my attention. Let's see. I'm looking. I was just looking to find the one that had caused me to put that on the list. Oh, here we go. Atomic Robo. I like the character, the way that they tie it to real history, as well as sort of a reimagined version of history. So, like, in the story, he's supposed to have been created by Tesla, and Edison was like his great nemesis.
Yeah.
And Edison is like this supervillain in the series of comics, but along the way, he fights Nazis, he fights a super intelligent dinosaur. They fight alien invaders. And even though those are serious sounding topics, it's always kind of with a bit of fun. they don't take themselves all that seriously. You know, his head, he kind of looks like a 1950s Buick or something.
Yeah, which is awesome.
With fins this latest series that I've been reading, it's called Dawn of a New Era. And his agency that he's a part of has been called on the carpet by the federal government, and they're under all these restrictions, despite the fact that they've been involved in all these super secret American activities over the decades. And they're building a new headquarters in Arizona, and like their neighbors there, or Jeff Bezos building a space fort, Richard Branson.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they mix real people and real history in with the make-believe. But, like I said, it's always with a bit of fun. And I just enjoy the lightness of the series and the humor of the series. The people who work for him, you know, they get upset about not taking their vacations or whatever.
Right.
So they seem like real people in a lot of ways that some fictional characters don't. But anyway, that's definitely been one that I've enjoyed. My tastes tend to sway a little bit more towards science fiction, so that's right. Why several of the ones that I had on my list are definitely sci-fi themed.
Now, these two creators on Atomic Robo, it's been the same two guys all the way through?
I don't think they've done it alone, but I think that they've been the primary, I mean, they're the creators of the character,
yeah.
And I think most of it has been primarily them. Every once in a while, I know I've seen one that looked like the art style was slightly different, so it was drawn by somebody else. But those names have been on most of the books that I've seen. So
nice. That is something that fascinates me. And when you mention it, other people have done some of it. I just talked about this on a recent episode. Was Howard Chaykin, when he was doing American Flag, which was one of my favorite comics ever done. But I think after he did about 12 issues, he started bringing other people in slowly. And, you know, basically, I don't think he was really involved except doing covers. And I stopped reading it after a while. I mean, I stuck with it for a long time. And then I remember later in the 80s, he came back to it with Mike Volsberg.
Right.
And ElfQuest, you know, the married couple, the Pennies, they were doing ElfQuest. They started having other people do it, you know, later on. And then they were in an interview kind of, I guess, not understanding why people weren't reading it. And they brought up that, you know, Jack Kirby, you know, Stan Lee did Silver Surfer. And then, you know, other people like John Buscema did it later and people still loved it. But the only thing I can say was, in the two cases I just gave you, they're really unique creators. And I think it's kind of hard to follow. And I've always wondered about that. If somebody's created a comic and then other people come in and take over, like it happens all the time in mainstream comics, I haven't always seen that work. I can't really think of too many times books I've read, if the original creators are involved, if they try to bring it on, it never really seemed to last. But it sounds like this one does. It seems like they're able to expand it to other people, but they've done what they wanted with it anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I think it not being a monthly book being created by somebody else that makes all the money off of it probably makes a big difference. I know that Howard Chaykin, at the time he stepped off from American Flag, certainly the company didn't want him to stop doing it because it was popular because of his work.
Right.
But I think he was being paid so much more to write stuff for Hollywood than for it to make sense for him to continue spending all of his time drawing the book. And then when he kind of more or less retired from screenwriting, he came back to comics and was doing a lot of stuff for Marvel. But now he's back doing some of his own independent stuff at first in other companies, and I'm glad to see it. Because I think he's frankly a lot smarter than most of the writers that he's ever worked with.
Yeah.
So I like to see his take on the world. He's got a very definitely interesting perspective and a healthy dose of skepticism, too.
Yeah, he does. One thing I had just read, I can't remember the name of that book. It was the one that had the Islamic lady with the Star-Spangled Banner on her burqa.
Right.
I can't remember the name of that, but there was one issue. There was a kid that was being hung.
United States of Hysteria.
That's
it.
I got those, and that's one thing I talked about on the show was I've always liked Howard Chaykin as an artist. That's why I bought the work. I've liked Howard Chaykin's artwork. I know he writes. As you know, I've always preferred writer-artist, you know, the same person creating, like Frank Miller did, you know, with some exceptions. But I didn't realize until I read The Hysteria, Howard Chaykin's a really great writer. I mean, I want to say that, it's foolish to say, because you know, he's writing for television for so long. I never really watched any of the shows he wrote, but I did.
Have you read any of the Hey Kids, It's Comics series that he's doing?
Yes, I talked about a couple on the show.
I was thinking you had.
Yeah, and I just got the last few issues. Kind of an odd story. I told my shop, it's a really good shop, that I was wanting that, and they got me the first couple of issues, and then they stopped. And I haven't reminded the guy. And I just realized that, you know, all the issues, the series is complete, and I didn't get them. So I ordered them online through a service.
Okay.
And so I've read the last three issues. And like I said, I've already talked about the series. One thing, as I said before, as much as I enjoyed it, one thing that kind of spoils it for me, and I know he didn't intend for me to read it this way, but I'm wanting to know who these people are. I mean, some of them, you know who the Jack Kirby character is. You know who the Stan Lee character is.
Yeah.
There was another character that I was attesting to Neil Adams. He draws him like Neil Adams when he's younger, but he doesn't act like Neil Adams, and they make some comments, and I'm thinking, that's not Neil Adams. I found out he was supposed to be a couple of the Image guys.
Yeah, Rob Liefeld.
Yeah. And, but I shouldn't have read it that way, but I did. And, I know some of them, one of the main three characters is kind of loosely based on Gil Kane, I'm guessing.
Right.
But that, like I said, when I was reading it, I couldn't just read the thing straight through. I was trying to figure who these people are. Some of it was kind of sad to me. I've always had a rose-colored glasses. Comics are my favorite thing. I mean, my wife knows whenever we go to another town, I want to find the comic shop. I'd love to get them. I worked for this guy one time. He and I were talking. He and I have a lot of the same interests. We're both in martial arts. You know, we both like a lot of the same thing. But he said, one day I said, you know, you're always upbeat. And he says, well, you're trying to make it in this hostile world. You got to keep this upbeat thing. And all I told him is, we live in a world of comic books and chocolate. Everything's okay. And, you know, he's like, so that's your basis, is comic books and chocolate. So that's all you need. That's all you need. But, reading the Howard Chaykin thing, one thing that always killed me was, you've heard the story, when somebody went to talk to Jack Kirby at a convention about, you know, being a cartoonist, and Jack Kirby supposedly said, kid, comics will break your heart. And that just always breaks my heart, because they never broke my heart. I never got to work in the industry, so I never lost that excitement to it. But reading this, it it's kind of hard. And when you read all the stories that you heard about people doing Tijuana Bibles and, you know, disappearing and going to advertising and then trying to come back and, you know, getting cheated. As much as I enjoyed the series, it kind of hurt, man. But at the end, the very end, it really put a lump in my throat. And it shows why we all love comics. I'm not going to even tell you the ending of it. But, I mean, like I said, this whole series with Howard Chaykin, it was a bitter, sometimes hostile thing. But at the very end of it, you could see he was showing what we've all loved about it. So it is a series I recommend. But what did you think of it?
Well, I think it's Chaykin's love letter to the industry, but it's a love letter written by a guy whose eyes were always wide open. I mean, he's not one for schmaltz.
No.
You know, he's telling things like it really happened to some of these people. And there were a lot of pretty horrible stories in terms of how the talent were treated. And I know we got a little bit of that from the old guard when we were able to meet some of those guys, certainly from Kirby, but also Gil Kane and Harvey Kurtzman and a few of the others, you know, that had wide open eyes about how they'd been treated. I feel particularly grateful to have met all those guys when they were still around, because, I mean, people getting into comics now, this history is all something that exists in the past, like the Civil War or something.
Yeah.
And I got to meet these guys and see them drawing, and so I feel like that's an experience that unfortunately is being lost for newer generations. I was thinking about this the other day. When I saw the movie Schindler's List, I had met several people who were imprisoned by the Nazis. Yeah. In fact, when I saw that movie in California, I was sitting directly behind three guys who had tattoos from the concentration camp that they were in. All those people are gone now. That makes me sad because, I mean, there's crazy people who are telling lies about, well, there was no Holocaust and there was never that many people killed and so forth and so on. But, you know, I actually knew people, even though it all happened before I was born, I knew people who had experienced it. So to me, it was very real. And I feel the same way about the early years of the comics industry. So much has changed over the course of the last 50 years during my life and yours that, I don't know, it's a weird and different perspective that people come to things now with.
You know, that's a good point. And that's something I think about all the time. That's one thing also I understand, because how many times you're growing up and you know hear people older than you say, well, you just don't know. And they talk about, you know, when they were younger and what things were like. Also, perspective changes as the, you know, the next generation grows up. Yeah. You're talking about some of the people. I didn't get to meet all the people you met, but I do remember meeting Howard Chaykin with you. I'll never forget that. I've always loved Howard Chaykin. I mean, I had a collection of Sword and Sorcery, you know, the Iron Wolf stuff. I had a lot of stuff he did in Heavy Metal and Star Reach. I always loved him. Some of the Marvel work he did, but I was always afraid of him. You know, I mean, just not meeting him, but just reading his work. And once in a while, I didn't have all the trade magazines at the time, but I'd read things he wrote, and I was afraid of him. And when we met him in Dallas, I just thought he was fantastic. He was really warm, forthcoming. He was still Howard Chaykin. He had that, you know, edge to him. But
sure.
he was gracious with his time. He was respectful. And he was basically there to educate us. I remember he would be at, you know, when he would talk on panels, he was trying to explain to people, you don't just look at, you know, Jack Kirby and Frazetta, is as good as they are. And he was bringing up a lot of people you had heard of, but I had not. It seems to me like he was always, to me, an odd one, because he loves comics, but he could, I guess he showed he could work outside of comics. He's in comics because he loves them, but he also understands the nature of the business and what it's about. Gil Kane was another one. When I'd read interviews with him, I was kind of shocked in the Comics Journal how, I hate to say it, but how bitter he was. But again, when we saw him in Dallas, he was the most congenial elder statesman I'd ever seen in my life. Very professional. Yeah. And like Howard Chaykin, he was basically there to encourage and educate the younger generations. And he was positive. So, yeah. Hey Kids Comics, I really loved. I really loved the ending. And what I really liked is at the bottom, he said, the end for now. Okay, so he's going to do some more then.
Yeah, well, I think anyone who's willing to put the time and effort into publishing Chaykin's work, that's going to be something I'm excited about, and it's going to be rewarding, because I think he continues to really put a lot in. And I'm always happy to see it.
Yeah.
Well, one of my other favorite cartoonists of all time is a guy named Mark Schultz, who did a series called Xenozoic Tales.
Yes.
Which has been published by, I don't know, four or five different publishers over the years. But I want to put in a good word for his current publisher. There's a guy named John Fleskes out in California. He lives in the Santa Cruz area where I used to live. And I never knew him. He worked for Sun Microsystems when I was living out there. But he started his own publishing company called Flesk, F-L-E-S-K, Publishing. And he's printed books featuring the art of Wendy Pini and Steve Rude and
Bruce
Mark
Kim.
Schultz and just Frank Cho. I just got a book of dinosaur paintings by, what's his name? Guy that...
William Stout?
I'm sorry?
Is it Stout? William Stout?
Yes, by William Stout. That's amazing stuff. They're paintings that are murals in a museum, and so they're very informed by the actual science that's known about all these creatures. But of course, like anything that Stout does, it's beautiful illustration. It's wonderfully informed compositions and just really impressive stuff. So I'm really glad that John is doing this publishing, because he's publishing just great stuff. And he's published a collection of all of the Xenozoic tales. So you don't have to go back and track down the Epic Comics and Dark Horse Comics and Kitchen Sink Comics, where they were all originally published. You can actually get this collection. It's practically an omnibus. And boy, when you're sitting there looking at this stuff over decades, you see how much Schultz's work improved. The last couple of issues he did are just amazing. And the even better news is he's currently working on the next storyline that Flesk is going to publish when he's done with it. And periodically they'll publish smaller books of like his commission drawings and advertising drawings that he did here and there. So I'm always glad to see more work from him. He also did an illustrated prose story called Storms at Sea. That was kind of fascinating stuff. It's set in the future, but of course with his drawing style that's richly informed by like early 20th century ink illustrators and early comic strips, it sort of looks like it's come from the past. It's kind of like a hard-boiled detective story, but set in the future when mankind is encountering other races that live on Earth, like deep in the ground. So it's almost like an Edgar Rice Burroughs kind of a novel, but with his beautiful artwork on almost every page, just gorgeous stuff. And I can't speak more highly of the artist or of the publisher, because I think they both do incredible work.
You know, I remember when Xenozoic Tales were coming out with it was a kitchen sink.
Right.
I never saw the book, but I would see Previews Magazine. You know, they'd always have little tiny images, black and white images of the artwork. And all I could see was the logo. And the line work was kind of lost being so small. You know, sometimes back then the printing was crude. And I just thought, oh, it's some underground guy trying to be, you know, Frazetta and failing. And a friend of mine mentioned he was reading it, and I just kind of rolled my eyes at it. Finally, at one point, I started seeing the work. The guy was, I'm saying this is in the early 90s when I found it. I bought the first trade that Kitchen Sink put out, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs.
Right.
And it's staggering. The very beginning, you know, you can see he was influenced by EC. So he had the very beginning, he looked like a cross between Harvey Kurtzman and Wally Wood, a rough Wally Wood.
Right.
And then as the series goes on, he starts getting this Frazetta, William Stout, Al Williamson kind of look. But, I mean, saying that, he was his own man. The story was neat. He's, again, like Howard Chaykin, he can create and write, and it's equal to the artwork, and that's saying something. I got the three volumes the Kitchen Sink put out, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, Dinosaur Shaman. I can't remember what the last one was called. But I loved them, and I've heard they were doing these omnibuses and stuff, but I said, well, I've got these. There was a podcast done out here in St. Petersburg called Mr. Media, and they had Mark Schultz on it.
Oh, yeah?
And he was talking about, this is years ago, but he was talking about the work and talking about the, you know, the artwork was, you know, as you know, backbreaking. And it says he was bringing it back, but it was going to be kind of a illustrated prose novel. He says, I can't see going back and doing comics again. But from what I understand, I think he has.
Yeah, well, you know, he's continued his interest and love, but it's been in sort of ancillary fashion. He's written a lot of stuff that wasn't his own, so like Flash Gordon stuff, working with Gary Gianni on Prince Valiant,
yeah,
and things like that, where it allows him to express his interest in comics, but without necessarily doing something where he's taking an entire week to draw a page, like he did with Xenozoic. So, but whenever they come out with it, I know I'll be picking it up, because his stuff really registers with me.
Yeah, me too. I think with a lot of people, to me, he's one of these guys that kind of came out from nowhere, and he was good from the start, and he's gotten better, and that's saying something.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, alright, I'll tell you what, while we're doing this, let's take a music break.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Two Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
All right, that was French Maid, who we played before. It was a band out of Erie, Pennsylvania, which I understand still carries on to this day, but my friend's no longer in the band, so there you go. All right. One thing we just finished talking about is Cenozoic Tales, which is fantastic, but you just read something else I'm interested in. It's a book about your, what I say is one of your very favorite creators, the Self-Created Man.
Yeah, Jim Steranko, this book is about him, and I haven't read it yet, but it's written by a friend of mine, a guy named James Romberger, who is an artist in New York City, and he's done comics before, but mostly he does work that hangs on a wall and sells in a gallery. His wife is a gallery administrator, so they're kind of the perfect artist team that way. But like me, Steranko has always been one of his big interests in the history of comics. I knew him because we both used to be in a Kirby listserv together, and you know, going back to the early days of internet chat. And he's always had fascinating perspectives about things, and this book is richly illustrated with examples of Steranko's work, mostly his Marvel stuff, but also some of his later work that showed up elsewhere, like in his own magazine. Some of the paintings that he did for different movies, like Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I finally got the chance to meet Jim Steranko about a year and a half ago. And so that was a big thrill for me. And he was coming back to town for a recent convention, and I had every intention of going. And unfortunately, I ended up going into the hospital instead when that was going on. It was back in November.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, who's a comic book artist that I used to work as an assistant for, went to that convention, but he didn't pay to attend the comic artist school that Steranko was teaching in the evening at this convention. And so the guys who were in that class with Steranko, he started at like 6 in the evening and went till like 4 in the morning.
Wow.
And it wasn't very expensive, and he just was, I mean, he's one of these guys from my experience when I saw him before, where if you can get him going, he just has all kinds of stories to tell, and he's a real character. So he kind of has that in common with Howard Chaykin, but really was interesting and influential at a time early in Marvel's history, and with very little work, made a real impact on the field and on a lot of young minds. So I continue to be fascinated by him and really appreciate his work. And let's see, this book is printed by a company called Ground Zero Books. And the title of it is Steranko, the Self-Created Man by James Romberger. So
that's the perfect title, honestly. Steranko is somebody that's fascinated me because I didn't have any of his comics as a kid, but I'd see them. Older kids would have them. He always had his own way, but it was a pop art kind of way. I know a lot of, like, Marvel always had pop art on their books, but his was a real deal. And you see kind of Salvador Dali things on it, and Victor Vassarelli,
right,
and stuff like that. And But they were neat. They were unique, especially the two-page spreads he did. A lot of times you see cartoonists do a two-page spread, it's like they were really kind of stretching it. He was one of the few, besides Jack Kirby and Joe Kubert, that could do it. They just kind of stagger you. The one that blows my mind the most is I thought he did a lot more work than he did. But in that Marvel Comics The Untold Story, which we've all read, my favorite thing was when he showed up at the Marvel offices and they weren't really hiring anybody outside. And he came in and Flo Steinberger said, well, he's not seeing anybody. And Stranko says, he'll want to see me. And so she took the portfolio back to Stan, and then she came back and says, he does want to see you. She was in disbelief. And I don't know, I had always read stories that he had been an illusionist or a magician. And I guess that's the story I've always heard, was that he was the one Jack Kirby based Mr. Miracle off of.
Right.
And I don't know, he was, and then when I got to know you, I found that he was doing Media Scene and it changed it to Previews Magazine. Again, going back to that Mr. Media podcast out of here, one time he had Ken Brusniak on, and
it was
interesting. But he was talking about he worked for Steranko, and for that magazine, you know, Media Scene, yeah, and Previews. And he said that Steranko had a house, and all the guys that worked in the magazine lived in it.
Huh.
He said he left because Gary Groth aimed a loaded gun at him. Who, I guess he thought that was funny, but Brusniak didn't, so he left. And I guess that's the thing, was it seems to me like Steranko knew how to choose talent as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, Brusniak did incredible work both on Media Scene and then on American Flag. I mean, so much of the appeal of American Flag rested on the type treatments, and that was all stuff he was doing, the different logos for the different TV shows and everything in that series. So he definitely had a significant contribution to make along the way.
Well, so he talked about that on a Mr. Media interview, because I didn't know this. He said that the deal it was made with First Comics and Howard Chaykin was Howard Chaykin just came from that, I guess, those four series of graphic novels, My Stars, My Destiny, I can't remember the other ones. There was four of them he did with Byron Priest.
I think one was Empire.
Yeah, one was Empire. My Stars, My Destiny. I can't remember the other two. I had one of those, and I was shocked at how beautiful they were.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he lost his shirt over it. He said that
he didn't. Chaykin did, or
no, he did. He said, I heard him in an interview on, I don't know what it was, if it was Sidebar or Word Balloon, but he said the only person that made any money off of Byron Priest's project was Byron Priest. But he said he basically was bankrupt. And, well, this is what Brusniak said. I never heard Chaykin say this. But First Comics set it up where he'd do a monthly comic for him, and he'd be the premier. I guess he made a lot of money. They paid him a lot of money. He owned the rights to it. And they brought in Brusniak. And, you know, Brusniak was being paid, whatever the rate was for a letterer. And Brusniak was saying all the demands Chaykin had, he would have to get typesetting, done. And then he'd paste his stuff in. This is before computers were out. So he'd have to go to a typesetter, and that wasn't cheap. And he said some of the demand was so high for what Chaykin wanted that he would do what he could. He'd use the rub-on letters, the chart pack, and Letraset and all that stuff. But he'd also have to go to typesetters and get it, and then he'd have the bill. And he'd send the invoice to Howard Chaykin, and they were staggering. And he says sometimes he's embarrassed to give it, and he says, well, Howard, this is the bill for it. And Howard Chaykin would be a little put out, but he understood and said, I'll just let it go. And But First Comics had to deal with him because I guess he wasn't making money with all the work he's doing for Chaykin. So they put him on that Mike Grill book, not Star Slayer, it was the other one, the mercenary guy.
John Sable Freelance.
Yeah, John Sable Freelance. Because he could get the same rate doing that, and I guess there was very little dialogue in it. So, and he said some pages didn't have anything, but he still got paid for those pages. And he said, so that was kind of an offset for all the heavy industry. He was doing heavy lifting on Howard Chaykin's book. So he was making a lot more money, you know, on another book that he didn't do much work on.
Well, I'm glad that they had some kind of accommodation, because that doesn't seem right otherwise.
You know, you were the one that put this in my head at one point. Was you had a book Dick Giordano did on, you know, how to do comics and stuff. And mm-hmm. in it, he had the part where Dick Dillon was in it. And I just told you, I hated Dick Dillon. I thought he sucked. I've changed my mind since, but as a kid and a young man, I didn't care for him, and I wondered why they even let him in comics. And your comment to me was, those guys make more money. And I couldn't wrap that around my head. All the cogs in my head just stopped clicking. And then you're talking about these guys like Michael Golden and stuff that do the work we love. They rarely do books, whereas these guys are doing, you know, at least a couple of monthly books. And you said maybe they offset the money by doing portfolios and, you know, stuff like that. I've since learned that that's just how the world works. But I just thought Michael Golden should be making, you know, 15,000 times the money that these guys are making. You know, so.
If everything was just.
Well, in saying that, I've grown to appreciate Dick Dillon. I just wish he would have. It seemed to me like as he got older, he got careless. But he had a unique way of doing things. But as a young man, I didn't see it. But
yeah, know. I think there were a lot of those Lifetime comics guys who the styles got looser and less impressive over time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, certainly Marvel had several of the. But they were the workmen that got a lot of the work done when the stars were out shining.
Yeah. Well, that's, I had a point. I just kind of lost it. Oh, that was what, when George Perez was starting to do Teen Titans at DC, that to me at the time was odd because Marv Wolfman and George Perez were both Marvel guys.
And yeah, and they'd done amazing work at Marvel before that even came along.
You know it. You know it. But when he went to DC, towards the end of George Perez's Marvel run, I don't know, I was kind of, it was incredible, and then all of a sudden he disappeared and he kind of come back, but sometimes he'd just be doing breakdowns. Wasn't as good. And, I mean, it's still good, but nowhere near the, you know, the depths he was reaching before. And then he went to DC and was doing Teen Titans, and it was an extremely popular book. And I'd go in the comic store, and he'd have customers tell the comic shop owner, I says, with all the great work you're seeing from Teen Titans, why isn't DC doing any more books like that? I remember the comic shop owner, it didn't matter what comic shop I was at, it was always, well, DC has a lot of hacks working for them. And I was thinking, why? Why don't they just get rid of all these guys? Well, come to find out, some of those guys I ended up liking quite well, you know, but as a kid, it just wasn't appealing to me. But I guess that's how it always is.
It's kind of amazing to consider the dynamic when Neil Adams came along, being alongside some of those guys that had drawn comics for, at that point, decades, and really hadn't updated their style or approach in all that time. And here's this guy coming in, drawing really cinematic, really photorealistic imagery. I bet that was pretty frightening to some of them.
Yeah, I think it was too. You know, it's something, I think I read this. I think it was Steranko that said that Marvel had him and DC had Neil Adams. And they were the only two young guys working there with, basically a bunch of old Golden Age guys.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned that to Al, and Al disagrees. He was talking about, what's the guy that drew the Hulk for so long that I never liked?
George Tuska?
No, well, yeah, it wasn't George
Tuska. Or Sal Buscema.
No, it wasn't either one of those, although I didn't like them as kids. Herb Trimpe.
Oh, yeah, right. Herb Tuska was Iron Man. I was getting them mixed up.
But I've grown to like George Tuska, but when I was a kid, I didn't. But Herb Trimpe was the younger guy. I was always surprised to find that out. There was a few, but I think they were there earlier. And like when Steranko and Adams both kind of showed up, and they were like the only one at the time that came in.
But they were both trying to do something original. I mean, Trimpe was one of those guys who was hired based on his ability to sort of follow the directions that Jack Kirby gave.
Yeah.
And I mean, he would be the one to say that. So I'm not putting him down. I'm just saying that was really how he saw his job. And then he kind of got dumped by Marvel when the Image Revolution happened there. And his style wasn't a hot commodity anymore. And he went into being a school teacher for a while. I had met him towards the end of his life, and he was a pretty interesting guy.
Wow. Wow.
He was passionate about airplanes when he was young, and he had a biplane, which he flew. And one of the comics he probably put as much effort into as anything else at Marvel was one called The Phantom Eagle, which was kind of a knockoff of Kubert's Enemy Ace comics from over at DC. But it was really, I mean, you know, he really loved drawing the planes as well as flying them.
I never knew that. I never knew. Well, he did comics for Marvel for a long time.
Yeah, he did. Well, I don't want to just talk bad about the Image Revolution, because Image has actually become one of my favorite publishers in the last few years. Once they got beyond just being a sort of boutique publisher for the comics done by the guys who started the company, because I could take or leave most of them, but they have gone on to publish things by other people that I think are spectacularly good. A couple that I've been reading, there's one called Monstrous that is written by, I think she's an American Chinese woman, Marjorie Liu, and it's drawn by a Japanese artist named Sana Takeda.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely gorgeous. It's a fantasy book about this girl that she has kind of a demon. Like, if you ever read any H.P. Lovecraft, it's kind of an elder god type situation, the thing that's living inside of her. And all of these different nations are sort of at the cusp of going to war, and they all have all these political machinations going on, and everybody wants to get their hands on this girl for one reason or another, because they know something about her or because they want to know what the deal is with her. And it's just been a really interesting book. It has a very manga-like sensibility, but it's very lushly illustrated, so it's much more fully realized than what I think of as most manga being. Just really beautiful stuff.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Have you seen it?
I've never read it. I've seen some of this on Facebook. I'm looking it up right now. I've seen the covers, and, you know, people have come on and shown examples. It is lush.
It's up to like issue 20, and the first two volumes that I think were the six issues apiece were available through the Hoopla app recently, because that's how I read them. And it's really a pretty great book. Another book I really like that Image is publishing is called East of West. And it's written by Jonathan Hickman, who's written a lot of mainstream books for Marvel and DC. And it's illustrated by a guy named Nick Dragata. I think that's how it's pronounced. I'm not positive. But it's sort of a future story about the apocalypse happening. And in this future, the United States has split up into like five different countries. There's the Kingdom of New Orleans, which is run by a royal family. And then there's the Republic of Texas, run by some cowboy-looking characters. Yeah. And then there's a nation of Native Americans that's like the center of the continent of the U.S. And then the West Coast is run by...
PRA.
They're Chinese. Huh. It's supposed to be the descendants of Chairman Mao.
Huh.
So it's the Red Chinese. And then there's a nation that's kind of sort of like the United States, and it's run, I think it's even run out of Washington, D.C. But in each of these nations, there's people at the top that are very corrupt, and they actually are adherents to this religious order that's trying to make the apocalypse come about. And some of the main characters in the story are the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And the main thread of the story is that death, the worst of the horsemen, kind of went off on his own and fell in love with this woman who was the daughter of Chairman Mao. And they had a child together, and the child is the beast of the apocalypse. And, so everybody's trying to get a hold of this child to be in control of whatever happens next. But there's a lot of like courtroom drama and just the machinations and wars going on between these different groups. The Native American, the tribal lands, they're very high tech. And there are very few of them left, but they control these vast technological resources. And it's a really smart writer kind of coming up with an alternate version of the apocalypse of the Bible in kind of a sci-fi context. And it's been really fascinating. I think that one's up to like issue 40. Let's see. Monstrous is up to issue 20, and East of West, the latest issue I've seen is issue 41.
It's strong. I've seen East of West in the shops. I've never picked it up. I'm looking through here thinking, I do like this, the description you gave, and the artwork is strong. It's got it's very illustrative, and it's got a really graphic sense to it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very different books from one another in terms of their artistic styles, but they're both pretty amazing. I've enjoyed them a great deal. And they both happen to be things that were brought to my attention because of this comic book monthly reading club that I'm in. Because I've been in it for several years, and every month we read a new book, and they try to make it very varied instead of it all being, you know, basic superhero stuff.
Right. You know, that interests me. You've talked to me about this comic reading club before. How did you find this?
They advertised it on some little handout flyers at area comic book shops, and it was originally meeting down at the Dallas Museum of Art, which I thought was particularly cool.
Yeah.
And the guy who runs it, my friend Josh, he worked for the Dallas Museum of Art at that time. Now, he actually teaches art at an area community college now. So we stopped meeting at the Museum of Art when he no longer worked there. And we've been meeting at the main Half-Price bookstore in Dallas. And fortunately, that's a place I can take the light rail train down to and get almost right to the door of. So it's possible for me without driving to get there and back.
Right.
But it's really enjoyable. It's not a very large group. There's probably not more than 10 of us, but everybody's professional. Everybody's an adult. It's not children. So you have a lot of varied interests. One guy, is a professional nurse who has worked in different nursing homes. One woman is a computer programmer. Josh is an art professor, as I mentioned. We've had a couple of other professors at various times and have a school teacher as well that she's always introducing graphic novels to her high school students. And so I like it because it brings things to my attention that I wouldn't have come across on my own.
That
I just,
nice.
You know, I'm never in a comic shop anymore, so it's one way of getting exposed to some things. And it isn't that I've liked everything that we've read, but it's been a pretty good batting average. There have only been a couple where I'm like, oh, well, I'm never going to get those hours back.
You know, it is something with comics I bring up a lot. As we were kids, Your stack of comics you had, it wasn't always one kind. You may have a lot of something that you liked, but we always had a mix of, say, mostly superheroes, but you had issues of Richie Rich. You had maybe a couple of issues of Archie, you know, Little Lulu, you know, stuff like that. There was a big mix. It wasn't just... A lot of people now, when they read comics, it's all Marvels or all Image, you know, when Image was new. And it's a certain kind.
Yeah, those other books are still out there, though. I mean, there's lots of stuff that's movie and TV tie-ins that are very definitely not superhero-related. You know, if you go into a comic shop, you're going to see a lot of stuff that isn't Marvel or DC.
Right. Well, yeah, there is a wide plethora. I mean, like, they have a lot of books off the cartoon series, like Adventure Time. It's on Cartoon mm-hmm. Network. Those books are actually, to me, kind of unique. Because when I was a kid, if you ever had a book that was a tie-in to a TV show like Pink Panther or Woody Woodpecker or something, they didn't seem anything like the cartoons. I read.
You must be referring to those terrible Star Trek comics from Gold Key.
Yeah, which I bought them because the cover paintings always caught me. You know, and again, I love Star Trek.
And then you'd have Spock talking into a communicator, and it was clearly a drawing of an electric toothbrush.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah. But when I say this, Al loved those, and he always talks about the Italian cartoonist that drew them. But. You know, when I say this, I put in books like Gru the Wanderer, as you know I'm a huge fan of, Usagi Yojimbo. There
sure.
are a lot of books like that now, but it just seems like a lot of people, and it's up to the person. I'm not telling them what not to do, but everybody kind of fine-tunes their collection into something of just one thing. And I like the fact that there is a big plethora of stuff, and I like when I go on Free Comic Book Day. A couple of years ago I went, and there was a mother with her little girl, and she brought her on Free Comic Book Day, and they were buying a bunch of trades, you know, like the Powerpuff Girls, you know, that she was getting trades of that stuff. And I guess they were getting My Pretty Pony. I didn't even know that was a comic book. And I guess they got a few of those. But she said, we're going to branch out. We're trying out the Powerpuff Girl. And I'm standing in line talking to them. And the little girl keeps showing me pages from the Powerpuff Girls where they turned them into chickens and they were throwing eggs at, you know, Mojo Jojo. I mean, she was excited about it. But again, we all had a mishmash of a collection, which I appreciated and I kind of miss, you know.
Sure.
Well, man, this has been actually a marathon, as I knew it would be. So, one thing, I know you said it's a small group, but if you have any information on this comic reading group, maybe we could put it on the blog if anybody else wants to read.
Well, there's a Facebook page. It's just called the Dallas Comic Book Club. If you type that in Facebook, it'll come up with the page for it, and they make the announcements there of what we're going to be reading on a given month, and it's sort of casual. We meet in the common areas of a big local bookstore, Half Price Books, and that's kind of nice because they sell DVDs and Blu-rays, they sell graphic novels, they sell comics. So, you know, when I'm there is probably the most comic shopping that I do. That's where I got this graphic novel called The Collector, which is by a European cartoonist named Sergio Toppi.
Yeah.
And I'm not that familiar with his work, except that I know I've seen it before. I think in Heavy Metal.
Me too, yeah.
Really gorgeous stuff. I mean, it's all black and white art, and just really, it reminds me a little bit of Walt Simonson's approach to inking. Lots of textures, lots of fine line work, gradations, but really, really nice stuff. And I haven't even started reading this. I bought it last month when I was at the book club, and it's just phenomenal looking. And of course, I got it cheap because I was at Half Price Books. So.
When I visit my brother in Oklahoma, Oklahoma City has 3 Half Price Books. And I go to every one of them. My wife loves that place. Yeah. I'm always happy. And it's exactly what you said. They got books. They got a really strong graphic novel section. Each one's different and unique. But I always find a DVD or a few DVDs. Sometimes I see them when they have old comic books and old Life magazines.
Yeah.
And they're not expensive, which blows my mind. And every time, every store I've been to, when you buy something, it seems like the people there are so happy you bought it. You know, like, oh man, I love this.
That's cool.
Yeah, I know. I always like that. It's like they're, I don't know, sometimes you go to bookstores and they're kind of resentful that you're taking the book out of the store.
They used to have a location that was about a mile away from my house. So I used to visit that store more frequently. And one of the things that I had bought there was just paging through their racks of magazine. They had copies of a magazine called 1984 that was a Warren magazine.
Yeah, I remember.
And it was all like science fiction stories instead of horror, which most of the other Warren magazines were horror. And, you know, they did The Rook, and I just loved that stuff. And I didn't get hardly any of it when it was being published at the time, but it just seemed like a treasure from the past. And going back and looking at the kind of things that they were advertising at the time, like picture books about Star Wars. And
Yeah, it's a strong store. One of the listeners we have, he's in San Antonio, Texas, James Perry. Hi, James. He's always sending me, He's always sending me books, so he bought from my half-price books.
Oh, that's cool.
It is nice, and I appreciate it. But some of the, James, you know, don't, you don't have to send me, oh, I found a half-price book, so it wasn't much, you know, since I read it and enjoyed it, I thought you might like it. But, like you, he says that's basically his comic shop, you know.
Well, there are still some comic book shops around the area here in Dallas, and every once in a while I make it to one. But because I don't drive anymore, that's kind of a tall order, because none of them are very close to where I live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we don't have any out here in Florida, so boo-hoo for us. But, well, hey, man, we've covered a lot of Gommet tonight. This has been fantastic. It's good talking to you again, buddy.
Likewise.
And, just a few other notes. This is, we have every time on the Facebook page, Facebook group, when we post a new episode, we have a comic cover. Several people have done them. Lately it's been Al and then James Perry. I mean, not James Perry, sorry. James Perry, I'd love for you to do some. But it's been Roddy Frey. And both of them been knocking them out of the park. Actually, they're making me want to do some more, and I'm kind of scared now. If you would like to do a comic cover, I'd appreciate it. Just send it to the blog. We have a contact page. And if you do that and you don't mind, we'll also post it under the cover gallery on the blog. Anyway, that's about it. Britt, you have anything you'd like to say?
Farewell to everyone, not from Dallas, but from Britt in Dallas.
All right. Hopefully you'll be back on the show at other times. I've been wanting Britt to be on the show since we've been doing this for about 6-7 years now. So, anyway, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you on the other side. And in the meantime, read more comics.